Disc 12.
Odda turned and stared south down the Pedradon's valley. He was hoping to see Alfred's troops, yearning for a glimpse of sunlight on spearheads. But of course there was nothing there except the trees stirring in the wind. Odda the younger sensed his father's uncertainty. "We can wait for 2 days," he urged. "Death will be no better after 2 days," Odda said heavily. I admired him then. He had been hoping not to fight, hoping that his king would rescue him. But in his heart, he knew I was right, and knew that these Danes were his responsibility, and that the men of Defnarshire held England in their hands and must preserve it.
"Dawn," he said, not looking at me. "We shall attack at dawn."
We slept in war gear. Or rather, men tried to sleep when they were wearing leather or mail, with sword belts buckled, helmets and weapons close. And we lit no fires, for Odda did not want the enemy to see that we were readied for battle. But the enemy had fires, and our sentries could watch down the slopes and use the enemy's light to look for infiltrators. None came.
There was a waning moon sliding in and out of ragged clouds.
The Danish fires ringed us, heaviest to the south by Canticton, where Guthrum camped. More fires burned to the east beside the Danish ships, the flames reflecting off the gilded beast heads and painted dragon prows. Between us and the river was a meadow, at the far side of which the Danes watched the hill, and beyond them was a wide stretch of marsh, and at the marsh's far side was a strip of firmer land, beside the river where some hovels offered the Danish ship guards shelter. The hovels had belonged to fishermen, long fled, and fires were lit between them. A handful of Danes paced the bank beside those fires, walking beneath the carved prows, and I stood on the ramparts and gazed at those long, graceful ships and prayed that Wind Viper still lived. I could not sleep. I was thinking of shields and Danes and swords and fear. I was thinking of my child that I had never seen, and of Ragnar the Fearless, wondering if he watched me from Valhalla. I was worrying that I would fail the next day when at last I came to the life gate of a shield wall. And I was not the only one denied sleep, for at the heart of the night, a man climbed the grassy rampart to stand beside me, and I saw it was Ealdorman Odda. "How do you know Ubba?" he asked. "I was captured by the Danes," I said, "and was raised by them. The Danes taught me to fight." I touched one of my arm rings. "Ubba gave me this one."
"You fought for him?" Odda asked, not accusingly, but with curiosity.
"I fought to survive," I said evasively. He looked back to the moon-touched river. "When it comes to a fight," he said, "the Danes are no fools. They will be expecting an attack at dawn." I said nothing, wondering whether Odda's fears were changing his mind. "And they outnumber us," he went on. I still said nothing. Fear works on a man, and there is no fear like the prospect of confronting a shield wall. I was filled with fear that night, for I had never fought man to man in the clash of armies. I had been at Esk's Hill, and at the other battles of that far-off summer, but I had not fought in the shield wall. "Tomorrow," I thought, "tomorrow." And like Odda, I wanted to see Alfred's army rescue us. But I knew there would be no rescue. "They outnumber us," Odda said again, "and some of my men have nothing but reaping hooks as weapons." "A reaping hook can kill," I said, though it was a stupid thing to say. I would not want to face a Dane if I carried nothing but a reaping hook. "How many have proper weapons?" I asked. "Harf," he guessed. "Then those men are our front ranks," I said, "and the rest pick up weapons from the enemy dead." I had no idea what I was speaking of, but only knew I must sound confident. Fear might work on a man, but confidence fights against fear. Odda paused again, gazing at the dark ships below. "Your wife and son are well," he said after a while.
"Good.
My son merely rescued her.
and prayed I was dead, I said. He shrugged. Mildred lived with us after her father's death, and my son became fond of her. He meant no harm, and he gave none. He held a hand out to me, and I saw in the small moonlight that he offered me a leather purse. The rest of the bride price, he said. Keep it, Lord, I said, and give it to me after the battle, and if I die, give it to Mildred. An owl went overhead, pale and fast, and I wondered what augury that was. Far off to the east, up the coast, far beyond the Pedradon, a tiny fire flickered, and that too was an augury, but I could not read it. My men are good men, Odda said, but if they are outflanked... Fear was still haunting him. It would be better, he went on, if Ubba were to attack us. It would be better, I agreed, but Ubba will do nothing unless the runestics tell him to do it. Fate is all. Ubba knew that, which is why he read the signs from the gods. And I knew the owl had been a sign, and it had flown over our heads, across the Danish ships, and gone toward that distant fire burning along the Sefern's shore. And I suddenly remembered King Edmund's four boats coming to the East Anglian beach, and the fire arrows thumping into the beached Danish ships, and I realized I could read the auguries after all. If your men are outflanked, I said, they will die. But if the Danes are outflanked, they will die. So we must outflank them. How? Odd asked bitterly. All he could see was slaughter in the dawn, an attack, a fight, and a defeat. But I had seen the owl. The owl had flown from the ships to the fire, and that was the sign. Burn the ships. How do we outflank them? Odda asked. And still I remained silent, wondering if I should tell him. If I followed the augury, it would mean splitting our forces, and that was the mistake the Danes had made at Aesk's Hill, and so I hesitated. But Odda had not come to me because he suddenly liked me, but because I had been defiant with Ubba. I alone on Sinwit was confident of victory, or seemed to be, and that, despite my age, made me the leader on this hill. Elderman Odda, old enough to be my father, wanted my support. He wanted me to tell him what to do, me who had never been in Great Shield Wall. But I was young, and I was arrogant, and the auguries had told me what must be done, and so I told Odda. Have you ever seen the Shade of Gengen? I asked him. His response was to make the sign of the cross. When I was a child, I said, I dreamed of the Shade of Gengen. I went out at night to find them, and I learned the ways of the night so I could join them. What has that got to do with the dawn? He asked. Give me 50 men, I said, and they will join my men, and at dawn they will attack there. I pointed toward the ships. We'll start by burning their ships. Odda looked down the hill at the nearer fires, which marked where the enemy sentries were posted in the meadow to our east. They'll know you're coming, he said, and be ready for you. He meant that 100 men could not cross Sinuit's skyline, go downhill, break through the sentries and cross the marsh in silence. He was right. Before we had gone 10 paces, the sentries would have seen us, and the alarm would be sounded, and Ubba's army, which was surely as ready for battle as our own, would stream from its southern encampment to confront my men in the meadow before they reached the marsh. But when the Danes see their ships burning, I said, they will go to the river's bank, not to the meadow, and the river bank is hemmed by marsh. They can't outflank us there. They could, of course, but the marsh would give them uncertain footing, so it would not be so dangerous as being outflanked in the meadow. But you will never reach the river bank, he said, disappointed in my idea. A shadow walker can reach it, I said. He looked at me and said nothing. I can reach it, I said. And when the first ship burns, every Dane will run to the bank, and that's when the 100 men make their charge.
The Danes will be running to save their ships, and that will give the 100 men time to cross the marsh. They go as fast as they can. They join me, we burn more ships, and the Danes will be trying to kill us. I pointed to the riverbank, showing where the Danes would go from their camp along the strip of firm ground to where the ships were beached. And when the Danes are all on that bank, I went on, between the river and the marsh, you lead the third to take them in the rear. He brooded, watching the ships. If we attacked at all, then the obvious place was down the southern slope, straight into the heart of Ubba's forces, and that would be a battle of shield wall against shield wall, our 900 men against his 1,200. And at the beginning we would have the advantage, for many of Ubba's men were posted around the hill, and it would take time for those men to hurry back and join the Danish ranks, and in that time we would drive deep into their camp. But their numbers would grow, and we might well be stopped, outflanked, and then would come the hard slaughter. And in that hard slaughter they would have the advantage of numbers, and they would wrap around our ranks, and our rearmost men, those with sickles instead of weapons, would begin to die. But if I went down the hill and began to burn the boats, then the Danes would race down the riverbank to stop me, and that would put them on the narrow strip of riverside land. And if the 100 men under Leofric joined me, then we might hold them long enough for Odda to reach their rear, and then it would be the Danes who would die, trapped between Odda, my men, the marsh and the river. They would be trapped like the Northumbrian army had been trapped at Jofurik. But at Esk's Hill, disaster had come to the side that first split its forces.
It could work, Odda said tentatively. Give me 50 men, I urged him. Young ones.
Young? They have to run down the hill, I said. They have to go fast. They have to reach the ships before the Danes, and they must do it in the dawn. I spoke with a confidence I did not feel,
and I paused for his agreement,
but he said nothing. Win this, Lord, I said, and I did not call him Lord because he outranked me, but because he was older than me. Then you will have saved Wessex. Alfred will reward you. He thought for a while, and maybe it was the thought of a reward that persuaded him, for he nodded. I will give you 50 men, he said. Ravan had given me much advice, and all of it was good. But now in the night wind, I remembered just one thing he had said to me on the night we first met. Something I had never forgotten. Never, he had said. Never fight Ubba. The 50 men were led by the Shire Reeve, Ador, a man who looked as hard as Leofric, and like Leofric had fought in the big shield walls. He carried a cut-off boar spear as his favourite weapon, though a sword was strapped to his side. The spear, he said, had the weight and strength to punch through mail, and could even break through a shield.
Ador, like Leofric, had simply accepted my idea.
It never occurred to me that they might not accept it. Yet looking back, I am astonished that the Battle of Cynwit was fought according to the idea of a 20-year-old who had never stood in a slaughter wall. Yet I was tall. I was a lord. I had grown up among warriors, and I had the arrogant confidence of a man born to battle. I am Uhtred, son of Uhtred. Son of another Uhtred, and we had not held Bebbanburg and its lands by whimpering at altars. We are warriors. Ador's men and mine assembled behind Cynwit's eastern rampart, where they would wait until the first ship burned in the dawn. Leofric was on the right, with the Heyhengel's crew, and I wanted him there because that was where the blow would fall when Ubba led his men to attack us at the river's edge. Ador and the men of Defnisher were on the left, and their chief job, apart from killing whomever they first met on the riverbank, was to snatch up flaming timbers from the Danish fires and hurl them into more ships. We're not trying to burn all the ships, I said. Just get 4 or 5 ablaze. That'll bring the Danes like a swarm of bees.
Stinging bees, a voice said from the dark.
You're frightened? I asked scornfully. They're frightened. Their auguries are bad. They think they're going to lose. And the last thing they want is to face men of Defnershire in a grey dawn. We'll make them scream like women. We'll kill them, and we'll send them to their Danish hell. That was the extent of my battle speech. I should have talked more, but I was nervous because I had to go down the hill first. First and alone. I had to live my childhood dream of shadow walking, and Leofric and Eador would not lead the 100 men down to the river until they saw the Danes go to rescue their ships. And if I could not touch fire to the ships, then there would be no attack, and Odda's fears would come back, and the Danes would win, and Wessex would die, and there would be no more England. "So rest now," I finished lamely. "It will be 3 or 4 hours till dawn." I went back to the rampart, and Father Willibald joined me there, holding out his crucifix that had been carved from an ox's thigh bone. "You want God's blessing?" he asked me. "What I want, Father," I said, "is your cloak." He had a fine woolen cloak, hooded and dyed a dark brown. He gave it me, and I tied the cords around my neck, hiding the sheen of my mail coat. "And in the dawn, Father," I said, "I want you to stay up here. The riverbank will be no place for priests." "If men die there," he said, "then it is my place." "You want to go to heaven in the morning?"
"No."
"Then stay here." I spoke more savagely than I intended, but that was nervousness. And then it was time to go, for though the night was still dark and the dawn a long way off, I needed time to slink through the Danish lines. Leofric saw me off, walking with me to the northern flank of Cynwit, which was in mooncast shadow. It was also the least guarded side of the hill, for the northern slope led to nothing except marshes and the Severn Sea. I gave Leofric my shield. "I don't need it," I said. "It will just make me clumsy." He touched my arm.
"You're a cocky bastard, Ursling, aren't you?"
"Is that a fault?"
"No, Lord," he said.
And that last word was high praise.
"God go with you," he added. "Whichever god it is."
I touched Thor's hammer, then tucked it under my mail. "Bring the men fast when you see the Danes go to the ships," I said.
"We'll come fast," he promised me, "if the marsh lets us."
I had seen Danes cross the marsh in the daylight, and had noted that it was soft ground, but not rank bogland.
"You can cross it fast," I said, then pulled the cloak's hood over my helmet.
"Time to go," I said. Leofric said nothing, and I dropped down from the rampart into the shallow ditch. So now I would become what I had always wanted to be, a shadow walker. Childhood's dream had become life and death, and touching Serpent Breath's hilt for luck, I crossed the ditch's lip. I went at a crouch, and halfway down the hill, I dropped to my belly and slithered like a serpent, black against the grass, inching my way toward a space between two dying fires. The Danes were sleeping, or close to sleep. I could see them sitting by the dying fires, and once I was out of the hill's shadow, there was enough moonlight to reveal me, and there was no cover for the meadow had been cropped by sheep. But I moved like a ghost, a belly-crawling ghost, inching my way, making no noise, a shadow on the grass. And all they had to do was look, or walk between the fires, but they heard nothing, suspected nothing, and so saw nothing. It took an age, but I slipped through them, never going closer to an enemy than 20 paces. And once past them I was in the marsh, and there the tussocks offered shadow, and I could move faster, wriggling through slime and shallow water, and the only scare came when I startled a bird from its nest, and it leapt into the air with a cry of alarm and a swift whirr of wings. I sensed the Danes staring toward the marsh, but I was motionless, black and unmoving in the broken shadow, and after a while there was only silence. I waited, water seeping through my mail, and I prayed to Hodur, blind son of Odin and god of the night. Look after me, I prayed. And I wished I had made a sacrifice to Hodur, but I had not, and I thought that Eldwulf would be looking down at me, and I vowed to make him proud. I was doing what he had always wanted me to do, carrying serpent breath against the Danes. I worked my way eastward, behind the sentries going to where the ships were beached. No grey showed in the eastern sky. I still went slowly, staying on my belly, going slowly enough for the fears to work on me. I was aware of a muscle quivering in my right thigh, of a thirst that could not be quenched, of a sourness in the bowels. I kept touching Serpent Breath's hilt, remembering the charms that Eldwulf and Breda had worked on the blade. Never, Raven had said, never fight Ubba. The east was still dark. I crept on, close to the sea now, so I could gaze up at the wide Sefern and see nothing except the shimmer of the sinking moon on the rippled water that looked like a sheet of hammered silver. The tide was flooding, the muddy shore narrowing as the sea rose. There would be salmon in the Pedradon, I thought. Salmon swimming with the tide, going back to the sea. And I touched the sword hilt, for I was close to the strip of firm land where the hovels stood and the ship guards waited. My thigh shivered. I felt sick. But blind Hodur was watching over me. The ship guards were no more alert than their comrades at the hill's foot. And why should they be? They were farther from Odda's forces, and they expected no trouble. Indeed, they were there only because the Danes never left their ships unguarded, and these shipguards had mostly gone into the fishermen's hovels to sleep, leaving just a handful of men sitting by the small fires. Those men were motionless, probably half asleep, though one was pacing up and down beneath the high prows of the beached ships. I stood. I had shadow walked, but now I was on Danish ground, behind their sentries, and I undid the cloak's cords, took it off and wiped the mud from my mail, and then walked openly toward the ships, my boots squelching in the last yards of marshland. And then I just stood by the northernmost boat, threw my helmet down in the shadow of the ship, and waited for the one Dane who was on his feet to discover me. And what would he see? A man in mail, a lord, a shipmaster, a Dane. And I leaned on the ship's prow and stared up at the stars. My heart thumped, my thigh quivered, and I thought that if I died this morning, at least I would be with Ragnar again. I would be with him in Valhalla's Hall of the Dead. Except some men believed that those who did not die in battle went instead to Niflheim, that dreadful cold hell of the Norsemen, where the corpse goddess Hel stalks through the mists, and the serpent corpse ripper slithers across the frost to gnaw the dead. But surely, I thought, a man who died in a hall burning would go to Valhalla, not to Grey Niflheim. Surely Ragnar was with Odin. And then I heard the Dane's footsteps, and I glanced at him with a smile. A chilly morning, I said. It is. He was an older man with a grizzled beard, and he was plainly puzzled by my sudden appearance. But he was not suspicious. All quiet, I said, jerking my head to the north to suggest I'd been visiting the sentries on the Sefern's side of the hill. They are frightened of us, he said. So they should be. I faked a huge yawn, then pushed myself away from the ship and walked a couple of paces north as though I was stretching tired limbs, then pretended to notice my helmet at the water's edge. What's that? He took the bait, going into the ship's shadow to bend over the helmet, and I drew my knife, stepped close to him, and drove the blade up into his throat. I did not slit his throat, but stabbed it, plunging the blade straight in and twisting it, and at the same time I pushed him forward, driving his face into the water, and I held him there so that if he did not bleed to death, he would drown. And it took a long time, longer than I expected. But men are hard to kill. He struggled for a time, and I thought the noise he made might bring the men from the nearest fire. But that fire was 40 or 50 paces down the beach, and the small waves of the river were loud enough to cover the Dane's death throes. And so I killed him, and no one knew of it. None but the gods saw it. And when his soul was gone, I pulled the knife from his throat, retrieved my helmet, and went back to the ship's prow, and waited there until dawn lightened the eastern horizon. Waited till there was a rim of grey at the edge of England. And it was time. I strolled toward the nearest fire. Two men sat there. "Kill one," I sang softly, "and two, then three, kill four and five, and then some more." It was a Danish rowing chant, one that I had heard so often on the Wind Viper. "You'll be relieved soon," I greeted them cheerfully. They just stared at me. They did not know who I was, but just like the man I had killed, they were not suspicious, even though I spoke their tongue with an English twist. There were plenty of English in the Danish armies. "A quiet night," I said, and leaned down, and took the unburned end of a piece of flaming wood from the fire. "Egil left a knife on his ship," I explained, and Egil was a common enough name among the Danes to arouse no suspicion. And they just watched as I walked north, presuming I needed the flame to light my way onto the ships. I passed the hovels, nodded to three men resting beside another fire, and kept walking until I had reached the centre of the line of beached ships. There, whistling softly as though I did not have a care in the world, I climbed the short ladder left leaning on the ship's prow, and jumped down into the hull, and made my way between the rowers' benches. I had half expected to find men asleep in the ships, but the boat was deserted, except for the scrabble of rats' feet in the bilge. I crouched in the ship's belly, where I thrust the burning wood beneath the stacked oars, but I doubted it would be sufficient to set those oars aflame, and so I used my knife to shave kindling off a rower's bench. When I had enough scraps of wood, I piled them over the flame and saw the fire spring up. I cut more, then hacked at the oar shafts to give the flames purchase, and no one shouted at me from the bank. Anyone watching must have thought I merely searched the bilge, and the flames were still not high enough to cause alarm. But they were spreading, and I knew I had very little time, and so I sheathed the knife and slid over the boat's side. I lowered myself into the Pedradon, careless what the water would do to my mail and weapons, and once in the river, I waded northward from ship's stern to ship's stern until at last I had cleared the last boat and had come to where the grey-bearded corpse was thumping softly in the river's small waves. And there I waited. And waited. The fire, I thought, must have gone out. I was cold. And still I waited. The grey on the world's rim lightened. And then, suddenly, there was an angry shout, and I moved out of the shadow and saw the Danes running toward the flames that were bright and high on the ship I had fired. And so I went to their abandoned fire and took another burning brand and hurled that into a second ship, and the Danes were scrambling onto the burning boat that was 60 paces away, and none saw me. Then a horn sounded again and again, sounding the alarm, and I knew Ubba's men would be coming from their camp at Canticton. And I carried a last piece of fiery wood to the ships, burning my hand as I thrust it under a pile of oars. Then I waded back into the river to hide beneath the shadowed belly of a boat. The horn still sounded. Men were scrambling from the fishermen's hovels, going to save their fleet, and more men were running from their camp to the south. And so Ubba's Danes fell into our trap. They saw their ships burning and went to save them. They streamed from the camp in disorder, many without weapons, intent only on quenching the flames that flickered up the rigging, and threw lurid shadows on the bank. I was hidden, but knew Leofric would be coming, and now it was all timing. Timing and the blessing of the spinners, the blessing of the gods. And the Danes were using their shields to scoop water into the first burning ship. But then another shout sounded, and I knew they had seen Leofric. And he had surely burst past the first line of sentries, slaughtering them as he went, and was now in the marsh. I waded out of the shadow, out from beneath the ship's overhanging hull, and saw Leofric's men coming, saw 30 or 40 Danes running north to meet his charge. But then those Danes saw the new fires in the northernmost ships, and they were assailed by panic, because there was fire behind them and warriors in front of them, and most of the other Danes were still 100 paces away, and I knew that so far the gods were fighting for us. I waded from the water. Leofric's men were coming from the marsh, and the first swords and spears clashed. But Leofric had the advantage of numbers, and Heyhengel's crew overran the handful of Danes, chopping them with axe and sword. And one crewman turned fast, panic in his face when he saw me coming, and I shouted my name, stooped to pick up a Danish shield, and Ador's men were behind us. And I called to them to feed the ship fires while the men of Heyhengel formed a shield wall across the strip of firm land. Then we walked forward, walked toward Ubba's army that was only just realizing that they were being attacked. We marched forward. A woman scrambled from a hovel, screamed when she saw us, and fled up the bank toward the Danes, where a man was roaring at men to form a shield wall. Ador, I shouted, knowing we would need his men now, and he brought them to thicken our line, so that we made a solid shield wall across the strip of firm land, and we were 100 strong, and in front of us was the whole Danish army, though it was an army in panicked disorder. And I glanced up at Sinwit and saw no sign of Odda's men. They would come, I thought. They would surely come. And then Leofric bellowed that we were to touch shields, and the limewood rattled on limewood, and I sheathed serpent breath and drew wasp sting. Shield wall. It is an awful place, my father had said, and he had fought in 7 shield walls and was killed in the last one. Never fight Ubba, Ravan had said. Behind us, the northernmost ships burned, and in front of us a rush of maddened Danes came for revenge, and that was their undoing, for they did not form a proper shield wall, but came at us like mad dogs, intent only on killing us. Sure, they could beat us, for they were Danes, and we were West Saxons. And we braced, and I watched a scar-faced man, spittle flying from his mouth as he screamed, "Charge at me!" And it was then that the battle calm came. Suddenly there was no more sourness in my bowels, no dry mouth, no shaking muscles, but only the magical battle calm. I was happy. I was tired too. I had not slept. I was soaking wet. I was cold. Yet suddenly I felt invincible. It is a wondrous thing, that battle calm. The nerves go. The fear wings off into the void, and all is clear as precious crystal, and the enemy has no chance because he is so slow. And I swept the shield left, taking the scar-faced man's spear thrust, lunged wasp-sting forward, and the Dane ran onto her point. I felt the impact run up my arm as her tip punctured his belly muscles, and I was already twisting her, ripping her up and free, sawing through leather, skin, muscle and guts, and his blood was warm on my cold hand, and he screamed, ale breath in my face, and I punched him down with the shield's heavy boss, stamped on his groin, killed him with wasp sting's tip in his throat. And a second man was on my right, beating at my neighbour's shield with an axe, and he was easy to kill, pointing to the throat, and then we were going forward. A woman, hair unbound, came at me with a spear, and I kicked her brutally hard, then smashed her face with the shield's iron rim so that she fell screaming into a dying fire, and her unbound hair flared up bright as burning kindling. And Heyhengel's crew was with me, and Leofric was bellowing at them to kill and to kill fast. This was our chance to slaughter Danes, who had made a foolish attack on us, who had not formed a proper shield wall. And it was axe work and sword work, butcher's work with good iron, and already there were 30 or more Danish dead, and 7 ships were burning, their flames spreading with astonishing speed.
Shield wall!
I heard the cry from the Danes. The world was light now, the sun just beneath the horizon. The northernmost ships had become a furnace. A dragon's head reared in the smoke, its gold eyes bright. Gulls screamed above the beach. A dog chased along the ships, yelping. A mast fell, spewing sparks high into the silver air. And then I saw the Danes make their shield wall, saw them organise themselves for our deaths, and saw the raven banner, the triangle of cloth that proclaimed that Ubba was here and coming to give us slaughter. Shield wall! I shouted. And that was the first time I ever gave that order. Shield wall! We had grown ragged, but now it was time to be tight, to be shield to shield. There were hundreds of Danes in front of us, and they came to overwhelm us, and I banged wasp sting against the metal rim of my shield. They're coming to die, I shouted. They're coming to bleed. They're coming to our blades. My men cheered. We had started 100 strong, but had lost half a dozen men in the early fighting. The remaining men cheered, even though 5 or 6 times their number came to kill them. And Leofric began the battle chant of Hegger, an English rower's chant, rhythmic and harsh, telling of a battle fought by our ancestors against the men who had held Britain before we came. And now we fought for our land again. And behind me a lone voice uttered a prayer, and I turned to see Father Willibald holding a spear. I laughed at his disobedience. Laughter in battle. That was what Ragnar had taught me, to take joy from the fight. Joy in the morning, for the sun was touching the east now, filling the sky with light, driving darkness beyond the world's western rim. And I hammered wasp sting against my shield, making a noise to drown the shouts of the Danes. And I knew we would be hard hit, and that we must hold until Odda came. But I was relying on Leofric to be the bastion on our right flank, where the Danes were sure to try and lap around us by going through the marsh. Our left was safe, for that was by the ships, and the right was where we would be broken if we could not hold. Shields! I bellowed. And we touched shields again, for the Danes were coming, and I knew they would not hesitate in their attack. We were too few to frighten them. They would not need to work up courage for this battle. They would just come. And come they did. A thick line of men, shield to shield, new morning light touching axe heads and spear heads and swords. The spears and throwing axes came first, but in the front rank we crouched behind shields, and the second rank held their shields above ours, and the missiles thumped home, banging hard, but doing no injury. And then I heard the wild war shout of the Danes, felt a last flutter of fear, and then they were there. The thunder of shield hitting shield, my shield knocked back against my chest, shouts of rage, a spear between my ankles, wasp sting lunging forward and blocked by a shield, a scream to my left, an axe flailing overhead. I ducked, lunged again, hit shield again, pushed back with my own shield, twisted the sacks free, stamped on the spear, stabbed wasp sting over my shield into a bearded face, and he twisted away, blood filling his mouth from his torn cheek. I took a half pace forward, stabbed again, and a sword glanced off my helmet and thumped my shoulder. A man pulled me hard backward because I was ahead of our line, and the Danes were shouting, pushing, stabbing, and the first shield wall to break would be the shield wall to die. I knew Leofric was hard-pressed on the right, but I had no time to look or help because the man with the torn cheek was thrashing at my shield with a short axe, trying to splinter it. I lowered the shield suddenly, spoiling his stroke, and slashed wasp sting at his face a second time. She grated on skull bone, drew blood, and I hammered his shield with my own. He staggered back, but was pushed forward by the men behind him. This time wasp sting took his throat, and he was bubbling blood and air from a slit gullet. He fell to his knees, and the man behind him slammed a spear forward that broke through my shield, but stuck there, and the Danes were still heaving. But their own dying man obstructed them, and the spearman tripped on him. The man to my right chopped his shield edge onto his head, and I kicked him in the face, then slashed Wasp Sting down. A Dane pulled the spear from my shield, stabbed with it, and was cut down by the man on my left. More Danes came, and we were stepping back, bending back, because there were Danes in the marshland who were turning our right flank. But Leofric brought the men steadily around till our backs were to the burning ships. I could feel the heat of their burning, and I thought we must die here. We would die with swords in our hands and flames at our back, and I hacked frantically at a red-bearded Dane trying to shatter his shield. Ida, the man to my right, was on the ground, guts spilling through torn leather, and a Dane came at me from that side, and I flicked Wasp Sting at his face, ducked, took his axe blow on my breaking shield, shouted at the men behind to fill the gap, and stabbed Wasp Sting at the axeman's feet, slicing into an ankle. A spear took him in the side of the head, and I gave a great shout and heaved at the oncoming Danes. But there was no space to fight, no space to see, just a grunting mass of men hacking and stabbing and dying and bleeding. And then Odda came. The Elderman had waited till the Danes were crowded on the riverbank, waited till they were pushing one another in their eagerness to reach and to kill us. And then he launched his men across Sinwit's brow, and they came like thunder, with swords and axes and sickles and spears. The Danes saw them, and there were shouts of warning, and almost immediately I felt the pressure lessen to my front as the rearward Danes turned to meet the new threat. I rammed Wasp Sting out to pierce a man's shoulder, and she went deep in, grating against bone. But the man twisted away, snatching the blade out of my hand. So I drew serpent breath and shouted at my men to kill the bastards. This was our day, I shouted, and Odin was giving us victory. Forward now, forward to battle slaughter. Beware the man who loves battle. Raven had told me that only one man in three, or perhaps one man in four, is a real warrior, and the rest are reluctant fighters. But I was to learn that only one man in 20 is a lover of battle. Such men were the most dangerous, the most skillful, the ones who reaped the souls, and the ones to fear. I was such a one, and that day beside the river where the blood flowed into the rising tide, and beside the burning boats, I let Serpent Breath sing her song of death. I remember little, except a rage, an exultation, a massacre. This was the moment the Skalds celebrate, the heart of the battle that leads to victory. And the courage had gone from those Danes in a heartbeat. They had thought they were winning, thought they had trapped us by the burning ships, and thought to send our miserable souls to the afterworld. And instead, the Ferd of Defnashir came on them like a storm. Forward! I shouted. Wessex! Leofric bellowed. Wessex! He was hacking with his axe, chopping men to the ground, leading the Hayhengal's crew away from the fiery ships. The Danes were going backward, trying to escape us, and we could choose our victims. Serpent Breath was lethal that day. Hammer a shield forward, strike a man off balance, thrust the blade forward, push him down, stab into the throat, find the next man. I pushed a Dane into the smouldering remnants of a campfire, killed him while he screamed. And some Danes were now fleeing to their unburned ships, pushing them into the flooding tide. But Ubba was still fighting. Ubba was shouting at his men to form a new shield wall to protect the boats. And such was Ubba's hard will, such his searing anger, that the new shield wall held. We hit it hard, hammered it with sword and axe and spear, but again there was no space. Just the heaving, grunting, breath-stinking struggle. Only this time it was the Danes who stepped back, pace by pace, as Odda's men joined mine to wrap around the Danes and hammer them with iron. But Ubba was holding his rearguard firm, holding them under the Raven banner. In every moment that he held us off, another ship was pushed away from the river's bank. All he wanted to achieve now was to save men and ships, to let a part of his army escape, to let them get away from this press of shield and blade. 6 Danish ships were already rowing out to the Severn Sea, and more were filling with men. I screamed at my troops to break through, to kill them. But there was no space to kill, only blood-slicked ground and blades stabbing under shields, and men heaving at the opposing wall, and the wounded crawling away from the back of our line. And then, with a roar of fury, Ubba hacked into our line with his great war axe. I remembered how he had done that in the fight beside the Yawash, how he had seemed to disappear into the ranks of the enemy only to kill them, and his huge blade was whirling again, making space, and our line went back, and the Danes followed Ubba, who seemed determined to win this battle on his own and to make a name that would never be forgotten among the annals of the Northmen. The battle madness was on him. The rune sticks were forgotten, and Ubba Lothbroxen was making his legend. Another man went down, crushed by the axe, and Ubba bellowed defiance. The Danes stepped forward behind him, and now Ubba threatened to pierce our line clean through. I shoved backward, going through my men, and went to where Ubba fought. There I shouted his name, called him the son of a goat, a turd of men, and he turned, eyes wild, and saw me. "You bastard whelp," he snarled, and the men in front of me ducked aside as he came forward. Mail coat drenched in blood, a part of his shield missing, his helmet dented and his axe blade red. "Yesterday," I said, "I saw a raven fall." "You bastard liar," he said, and the axe came around, and I caught it on the shield, and it was like being struck by a charging bull. He wrenched the axe free, and a great sliver of wood was torn away to let the new daylight through the broken shield. "A raven," I said, "fell from a clear sky." "You whore's pup," he said, and the axe came again, and again the shield took it, and I staggered back, the rent in the shield widening. "It called your name as it fell," I said. "English field," he shouted, and swung a third time. But this time I stepped back and flicked serpent breath out in an attempt to cut off his axe hand. But he was fast, snake fast, and he pulled back just in time. "Raven told me I would kill you," I said. "He foretold it in a dream by Odin's pit. Among the blood he saw the raven banner fall." "Liar," he screamed, and came at me, trying to throw me down with weight and brute force. I met him, shield boss to shield boss, and I held him, swinging serpent breath at his head. But the blow glanced off his helmet, and I leaped back a heartbeat before the axe swung where my legs had been, lunged forward, and took him clean on the chest with serpent breath's point. But I did not have any force in the blow, and his mail took the lunge and stopped it. And he swung the axe up, trying to gut me from crotch to chest. But my ragged shield stopped his blow, and we both stepped back. "Three brothers," I said, "and you alone of them live. Give my regards to Ivar and to Halfdan. Say that Uhtred Ragnarsson sent you to join them." "Bastard," he said, and he stepped forward, swinging the axe in a massive sideways blow that was intended to crush my chest. But the battle calm had come on me, and the fear had flown, and the joy was there, and I rammed the shield sideways to take his axe strike, felt the heavy blade plunge into what was left of the wood, and I let go of the shield's handle so that the half-broken tangle of metal and wood dangled from his blade. And then I struck at him. Once, twice. Both of them huge blows, using both hands on Serpent Breath's hilt, and using all the strength I had taken from the long days at Heyhengel's oar. I drove him back, cracked his shield, and he lifted his axe, my shield still cumbering it, and then slipped. He had stepped on the spilt guts of a corpse, and his left foot slid sideways. While he was unbalanced, I stabbed Serpent Breath forward, and the blade pierced the mail above the hollow of his elbow, and his axe arm dropped, all strength stolen from it. Serpent Breath flicked back to slash across his mouth, and I was shouting. There was blood in his beard, and he knew then, knew he would die, knew he would see his brothers in the corpse hall. He did not give up. He saw death coming and fought it by trying to hammer me with his shield again. But I was too quick, too exultant, and the next stroke was in his neck, and he staggered, blood pouring onto his shoulder, more blood trickling between the links of his chainmail. And he looked at me as he tried to stay upright. "Wait for me in Valhalla, Lord," I said. He dropped to his knees, still staring at me. He tried to speak, but nothing came, and I gave him the killing stroke. "Now finish them!" Elderman Odder shouted, and the men who had been watching the duel screamed in triumph and rushed at the enemy. And there was panic now as the Danes tried to reach their boats. Some were throwing down weapons, and the cleverest were lying flat, pretending to be dead, and men with sickles were killing men with swords. The women from Sinwit's summit were in the Danish camp now, killing and plundering. I knelt by Ubba and closed his nerveless right fist about the handle of his war axe. "Go to Valhalla, Lord," I said. He was not dead yet, but he was dying, for my last stroke had pierced deep into his neck. And then he gave a great shudder, and there was a croaking noise in his throat, and I kept on holding his hand tight to the axe as he died. A dozen more boats escaped, all crowded with Danes, but the rest of Ubba's fleet was ours. And while a handful of the enemy fled into the woods where they were hunted down, the remaining Danes were either dead or prisoners, and the Raven Banner fell into Odda's hands, and we had the victory that day. And Willibald, spear point reddened, was dancing with delight. We took horses, gold, silver, prisoners, women, ships, weapons, and mail. I had fought in the shield wall. Elderman Odda had been wounded, struck on the head by an axe that had pierced his helmet and driven into his skull. He lived, but his eyes were white, his skin pale, his breath shallow, and his head matted with blood. Priests prayed over him in one of the small village houses, and I saw him there, but he could not see me, could not speak, perhaps could not hear. But I shoved two of the priests aside, knelt by his bed, and thanked him for taking the fight to the Danes. His son, unwounded, his armour apparently unscratched in the battle, watched me from the darkness of the room's far corner. I straightened from his father's low bed. My back ached, and my arms were burning with weariness. "I am going to Kridgenton," I told young Odda. He shrugged as if he did not care where I went. I ducked under the low door where Leofric waited for me.
"Don't go to Kridgenton," he told me.
"My wife is there," I said. "My child is there."
"Alfred is at Exonchester," he said.
"So?"
"So the man who takes news of this battle to Exonchester gets the credit for it," he said.
"Then you go," I said. The Danish prisoners wanted to bury Ubba, but Odda the younger had ordered the body to be dismembered and its pieces given to the beasts and birds. That had not been done yet, though the great battle axe that I had put in Ubba's dying hand was gone, and I regretted that, for I had wanted it. But I wanted Ubba treated decently as well, and so I let the prisoners dig their grave. Odda the younger did not confront me, but let the Danes bury their leader and make a mound over his corpse, and thus send Ubba to his brothers in the corpse hall. And when it was done, I rode south with a score of my men, all of us mounted on horses we had taken from the Danes. I went to my family, These days, so long after that battle at Cynwyt, I employ a harpist. He is an old Welshman, blind but very skilful, and he often sings tales of his ancestors. He likes to sing of Arthur and Guinevere, of how Arthur slaughtered the English. But he takes care not to let me hear those songs, instead praising me and my battles with outrageous flattery by singing the words of my poets, who describe me as Uhtred Strongsword, or Uhtred Deathgiver, or Uhtred the Beneficent. I sometimes see the old blind man smiling to himself as his hands pluck the strings, and I have more sympathy with his scepticism than I do with the poets who are a pack of snivelling sycophants. But in the year 877, I employed no poets and had no harpist. I was a young man who had come dazed and dazzled from the shield wall, and who stank of blood as I rode south. Yet for some reason, as we threaded the hills and woods of Defnisshire, I thought of a harp. Every lord has a harp in the hall. As a child, before I went to Ragnar, I would sometimes sit by the harp in Bebbanburg's hall, and I was intrigued by how the strings would play themselves. Pluck one string, and the others would shiver to give off a tiny music.
"Wasting your time, boy," my father had snarled as I crouched by the harp one day.
And I suppose I had been wasting it. But on that spring day in 877, I remembered my childhood's harp and how its strings would quiver if just one was touched. It was not music, of course, just noise, and scarcely audible noise at that. But after the battle in Pedradon's valley, it seemed to me that my life was made of strings, and if I touched one, then the others, though separate, would make their sound. I thought of Ragnar the Younger, and wondered if he lived, and whether his father's killer Kjartan still lived, and how he would die if he did. And thinking of Ragnar made me remember Breda, and her memory slid on to an image of Mildrith, and that brought to my mind Alfred and his bitter wife Elswith, and all those separate people were a part of my life, strings strung on the frame of Uhtred, and though they were separate, they affected one another, and together they would make the music of my life. Daft thoughts, I told myself. Life is just life. We live, we die, we go to the corpse hall. There is no music, just chance. Fate is relentless.
What are you thinking?
Leofric asked me. We were riding through a valley that was pink with flowers. I thought you were going to Exonchester, I said.
I am, but I'm going to Cridgenton first, then taking you on to Exonchester. So what are you thinking? You look gloomy as a priest.
I'm thinking about a harp.
A harp? He laughed. Your head's full of rubbish.
Touch a harp, I said, and it just makes noise. But play it, and it makes music.
Sweet Christ!
He looked at me with a worried expression.
You're as bad as Alfred. You think too much.
He was right. Alfred was obsessed by order, obsessed by the task of marshalling life's chaos into something that could be controlled. He would do it by the church and by the law, which are much the same thing. But I wanted to see a pattern in the strands of life. In the end, I found one. And it had nothing to do with any god, but with people. With the people we love. My harpist is right to smile when he chants that I am Uhtred the Gift-Giver, or Uhtred the Avenger, or Uhtred the Widow-Maker. For he is old, and he has learned what I have learned. That I am really Uhtred the Lonely. We are all lonely, and all seek a hand to hold in the darkness. It is not the harp, but the hand that plays it.
It will give you a headache, Leofric said. Thinking too much.
Aisling, I said to him.
Mildrith was well. She was safe. She had not been raped. She wept when she saw me, and I took her in my arms, and wondered that I was so fond of her. And she said she had thought I was dead, and told me she had prayed to her God to spare me. And she took me to the room where our son was in his swaddling clothes. And for the first time, I looked at Uhtred, son of Uhtred. And I prayed that one day he would be the lawful and sole owner of lands that are carefully marked by stones and by dikes, by oaks and by ash, by marsh and by sea. I am still the owner of those lands that were purchased with our family's blood, and I will take those lands back from the man who stole them from me, and I will give them to my sons, for I am Uhtred, Earl Uhtred, Uhtred of Bebbanburg, and destiny is everything. Historical note. Alfred, famously, is the only monarch in English history to be accorded the honour of being called the Great, and this novel, with the ones that follow, will try to show why he gained that title. I do not want to anticipate those other novels, but broadly, Alfred was responsible for saving Wessex, and ultimately English society from the Danish assaults, and his son Edward, daughter Ethelflaed, and grandson Ethelstan finished what he began to create, which was, for the first time, a political entity they called Englerland. I intend Uhtred to be involved in the whole story. But the tale begins with Alfred, who was indeed a very pious man and frequently sick. A recent theory suggests that he suffered from Crohn's disease, which causes acute abdominal pains, and from chronic piles, details we can glean from a book written by a man who knew him very well, Bishop Asser, who came into Alfred's life after the events described in this novel. Currently, there is a debate whether Bishop Asser did write that life, or whether it was forged 100 years after Alfred's death, and I am utterly unqualified to judge the arguments of the contending academics. But even if it is a forgery, it contains much that has the smack of truth, suggesting that whoever wrote it knew a great deal about Alfred. The author, to be sure, wanted to present Alfred in a glowing light, as warrior, scholar, and Christian, but he does not shy away from his hero's youthful sins. Alfred, he tells us, was unable to abstain from carnal desire until God generously made him sick enough to resist temptation. Whether Alfred did have an illegitimate son, Osfath, is debatable, but it seems very possible. The biggest challenge Alfred faced was an invasion of England by the Danes. Some readers may be disappointed that those Danes are called Northmen or Pagans in the novel, but are rarely described as Vikings. In this, I follow the early English writers, who suffered from the Danes and who rarely used the word Viking, which anyway describes an activity rather than a people or a tribe. To go Viking meant to go raiding, and the Danes who fought against England in the 9th century, though undoubtedly raiders, were preeminently invaders and occupiers. Much fanciful imagery has been attached to them, chief of which are the horned helmet, the berserker, and the ghastly execution called the spread eagle, by which a victim's ribs were splayed apart to expose the lungs and heart. That seems to have been a later invention, as does the existence of the berserker, the crazed naked warrior who attacked in a mad frenzy. Doubtless there were insanely frenzied warriors, but there is no evidence that lunatic nudists made regular appearances on the battlefield. The same is true of the horned helmet, for which there is not a scrap of contemporary evidence. Viking warriors were much too sensible to place a pair of protuberances on their helmets, so ideally positioned as to enable an enemy to knock the helmet off. It is a pity to abandon the iconic horned helmets, but alas, they did not exist. The assault on the church by the Danes is well recorded. The invaders were not Christians and saw no reason to spare churches, monasteries, and nunneries from their attacks, especially as those places often contained considerable treasures. Whether the concerted attack on the northern monastic houses happened is debatable. The source is extremely late, a 13th century chronicle written by Roger of Wendover, but what is certain is that many bishoprics and monasteries did disappear during the Danish assault, and that assault was not a great raid, but a deliberate attempt to eradicate English society and replace it with a Danish state. Ivar the Boneless, Ubba, Halfdan, Guthrum, the various kings, Alfred's nephew Ethelwald, Ealdorman Odda, and the ealdorman whose names began with A, a vanished letter called the Ash, all existed. Alfred should properly be spelt Aelfred, but I preferred the usage by which he is known today. It is not certain how King Edmund of East Anglia died, though he was certainly killed by the Danes, and in one ancient version, the future saint was indeed riddled with arrows like Saint Sebastian. Ragnar and Uhtred are fictional, though a family with Uhtred's name did hold Bebbanburg, now Bamber Castle. Later in the Anglo-Saxon period, and as that family are my ancestors, I decided to give them that magical place a little earlier than the records suggest. Most of the major events happened. The assault on York, the siege of Nottingham, the attacks on the Four Kingdoms all are recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, or in Asser's Life of King Alfred, which together are the major sources for the period. I used both those sources, and also consulted a host of secondary works. Alfred's life is remarkably well documented for the period, some of that documentation written by Alfred himself. But even so, as Professor James Campbell wrote in an essay on the king, arrows of insight have to be winged by the feathers of speculation. I have feathered lavishly, as historical novelists must, yet as much of the novel as possible is based on real events. Guthrum's occupation of Wareham, the exchange of hostages and his breaking of the truce, his murder of the hostages and occupation of Exeter all happened, as did the loss of most of his fleet in a great storm off Durlston Head near Swanage. The one large change I have made was to bring Ubba's death forward by a year, so that in the next book, Uhtred can be elsewhere. And persuaded by the arguments in John Peddy's book, Alfred, Warrior King, I placed that action at Cannington in Somerset, rather than at the more traditional site of Countisbury Head in North Devon. Alfred was the king who preserved the idea of England, which his son, daughter, and grandson made explicit. At a time of great danger, when the English kingdoms were perilously near to extinction, he provided a bulwark that allowed the Anglo-Saxon culture to survive. His achievements were greater than that, but his story is far from over, so Uhtred will campaign again.
The Last Kingdom by Bernard Cornwell was read by Tom Selwood, and is published by BBC Audiobooks.